BCFM 93.2. Bristol is our community.
Now let's move on to discuss the Merchant Ventures. As I said at the top of the hour, I think it's probably a good idea to put it in context where these Bristol merchants come from, because even before the Merchant Ventures was formed, we had a very strong merchant contingent in the city. They were involved in financing the trip to the United States, which was not sort of it was Newfoundland, and to help discover America, which was of course already been discovered by Native Americans, and then there was a massive genocide over hundreds of years after that, with 75 million Native Americans that died. Then the Merchant Venturers were formed. They conducted the slave trade, where between 5-6 million. Died on the Middle Passage, being taken from Africa, rounded up, treated like animals, basically put on slave ships and sent over to the Caribbean. So we had before Christmas the new master of the Merchant Ventures, Chris Curling, on here talking about his work. But I'm joined now by Daphne Havercroft from Southwest Whistleblowers Health Action Group, and Christine Townsend, who works in education. Hi, both of you, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello, Tony.
Hello, thank you.
I think we'll start with you first, Daphne. The merchants are getting a little bit more open about who their members are. They've got a website with a list of them and some of the things that they do. But can we look at it from a different point of view, just from health on its own, for example? Whereabouts, because much of the money that's spent on health, of course, is taxpayers' money, public money, but merchants are there, aren't they, helping to spend it?
Yeah, they're in a very influential position. And if we look at the two major hospital trusts in Bristol, so there's North Bristol NHS Trust, their former chair was Alfred Morris, who's a merchant. The current chair is Peter Rylett, who's a merchant. He's, if you look at education, he's also was a governor at, or chair of governors at Bristol Grammar. At University Hospitals Bristol NHS Foundation Trust, we've got John Savage, who's been the board chair since December 2006. And one of the leading consultants at that hospital, Dr. Jacqueline Cornish, who was the head of Women's and Children's, the division at the Bristol Children's Hospital. And she is now a consultant in bone marrow transplant, but also in a senior position at NHS England, a national director in women's and children's services.
I wonder whether it's which way round it all works. Are these people merchant venturers and then go on to these boards, or do the merchant venturers look around saying, who's doing well in the city? Somebody seems to be doing quite well, we'll invite them to join.
Well, I think the merchants select the people that they want to be part of their band of merchant venturers. And if you look on their website, it gives the list of who the people are, and you can go in and find out all the things they're involved in and their background. So it is, as I understand it, membership by invitation. And that gives them a stepping stone into some very influential positions in health, in business, in education.
And one of the things I was quite shocked by was the number of charities and trusts that the merchant venturers are involved in. So let's have a little listen now to what I think is one of the definitive bits of work on this, on the merchants, which is James Garrett's documentary that he did back in 1995 for HTV.
If the merchants is about one thing, it's about charity, it's about being involved in the administration of 12 charities and 40 trusts.
That's quite a lot, isn't it? 12 charities and 40 trusts, he's saying. And that's just one person from Merchant Ventures. So Daphne, what's your impression of where the wealth comes from the merchants? It's obviously historical, and much of it is kept in trust. Much of it's given out as charitable works. But how do we get a handle on how big it is? Because one of the first things I came across was the fact that you cannot actually get the accounts from Companies House because they have a royal charter and they are exempt.
Yeah, well, it's difficult to know where the money comes from. And if you look at one of the charitable organisations that the merchants are involved in, which is St Monica's, so residential homes, retirement homes, so they administer that, they're the trustees for it. But then the question is, where does the money come from? Well, we know that some of it comes from the NHS, because acute hospitals, where they've got the problems, both the Bristol hospitals, over bed blocking and getting people into being cared for, because they have a shortage of beds because of the difficulty of discharging people. And I understand that some of them are going into homes that are run by the merchant venturers.
Now, so I can remember when I was working for Avon Fire Service years ago, the deputy fire chief over in Bath, I think he was based, he had his own little charity, which was to do with training. And then the fire service were sending all of their new recruits to his charity for training. And actually, he was making quite a bit of money out of that. And when someone wrote a comment in the fire service magazine about it, I think it was a slightly sort of jaunty, witty comment taking the mickey out of him. The chief leant over the shoulder of the woman who was editing the local fire magazine and said, "No, we're not having that in." Basically, so we're not putting that in the local in our little Avon Fire Service magazine. But there is the danger, isn't there, of that kind of thing. Christine, you work in education and you've looked quite a lot at the merchants and which schools they are now running. Maybe you could start with the ones that they've run for a long time and just tell us, whereabouts are the merchants in our city schools?
The ones that they've run for a long time are some of the most kind of prestigious, I suppose you'd say, private schools. So they're involved in QEH. They founded Colston School over in French A. They founded Colston Girls School when that was a private school. They've been involved in Bristol Cathedral School for many years. And of course, a couple of those are now state schools.
See, this is blurring the lines a bit, isn't it? We've started off with private schools, and now we've got these kind of half-private, half-state schools, which are, although it's still run as a private school, and they're quite selective about where they take the recruits, bring in new young people in there, they're now state-funded.
Yeah, Cathedral Girls School and what is now Bristol Cathedral Choir School were the first two private schools in the country to come into the state sector as academies.
Well, that's interesting
because Bristol's
pioneered that, but is it a good thing?
Well, I would argue that it's not a good thing because one of the things about academies that's different to being a local authority school is that the schools themselves and the people that run the schools get to write their own admissions policies. So they decide, so long as it's within the law, how they're going to allocate their places. But the people that administer that are the same people that write the policy. And that's kind of part of what I've been looking at, is to kind of, okay, well, who's writing this policy and who's administering this policy and how does this system actually work?
Okay, well, what about academies? Because I know there are sort of chains that run academies, aren't there? But one of them I was looking at the other day, which looks a little bit iffy, was something called ARC Academies. I mean, so are these basically like run like private businesses, charities? How does it work?
Well, the academies have charitable status. They're supposed to be, they are allowed to make money on their assets. So they are allowed to hire out their premises and the money that is made comes in and that becomes part of the money that is then supposed to be spent on the education of the children and to improve the kind of the education service that they're providing. So they are allowed to do that. And what I actually find very interesting is that the Bristol Cathedral Choir School still has 30 acres of playing field up in Fayland, you know, the other side of the bridge, because it always had those playing fields when it was a private school. Now, when I looked at the expression of interest, which is like the first document that the school would have filled out when it was a private school, it actually paid the city council, who owns the land, nothing per year to rent, to hire this land. And in 2018, the rent is due to go up to £500 a year. Now, that school can hire that playing fields out, and it does, and it, you know, that's part of kind of what it's allowed to be doing. But if it's only given our council £500 for the pleasure of that, the rest of that money is supposed to be ploughed back into that school, which, you know, you may or may not have a problem with. But when we look at who that school is then serving, then it becomes an issue, because some of those places every year are going to children that don't live in the city. and hundreds of Bristol children that do live in the city get turned away.
Well, we've been sold this idea that academies are somehow going to be better than the old-fashioned schools. I noticed in The Guardian just this week, no proof that academies raise standards, finds inquiry in education. The Education Committee makes a series of recommendations to address the concerns over governance, transparency and oversight. And of course, this links in with what you have been saying about health, Daphne, is that, what we're dealing with now is actually rather secretive organisations. It's rather difficult. And, you know, you yourself have been expelled, you know, as if you've done something wrong from school, you know, from the Central Bristol Hospital Trust.
Well, this is where foundation trusts come in, because University Hospitals Bristol is a foundation trust, which means that they have more autonomy about how they spend their profits. They don't have to send as much money back to the Department of Health. And so you've got a merchant venturer, John Savage, who is the chair of the board. The only way that the public can get to scrutinise what he and his board are doing and hold them to account is through the governors. Now, some of them are elected by staff, some of them are elected by patients and the public, if they happen to be members of the trust. But the only way these volunteer governors can actually hold the board to account on behalf of us is by managing the performance of the chair and the non-executives. Now, the chair, John Savage, chairs the Governor's Membership Council. So you would have to have some very determined and strong governors to actually stand up to him, manage his performance and hold him to account for him.
Yes, and someone who's sat on committees with John, I think I'd agree with you, it would have to be extremely tough to stand up to him. I mean,
and I've done that. I've stood up to him and I got booted as a Foundation Trust member.
But was there any actual evidence or reason given for you being told that you weren't allowed to continue as a
there
trust
was,
member?
Oh, there was something that was circulated around the governors that I had cost £720,000 of public money through Freedom of Information activities. So I've asked them to substantiate it, and they won't.
Okay, you must have sent how many thousands of Freedom of Information requests did you send?
I can't remember, but there is no law that says that there's a limit on Freedom of Information requests that anyone can send.
So have you sent them 1,000 Freedom of Information requests?
No, not at all. I mean, Heather Brooke, who exposed the MP's expenses, I remember she did a talk in Bristol and said she was on about her 600th. So I haven't done anything approaching that. But Freedom of Information, accountability, and the NHS Code of Conduct for boards is that they have to hold themselves to account and open themselves up to public scrutiny. But when you try that, they don't want to be scrutinised. And so if you don't want to be open about what you're doing, that says to me, what are you hiding? What are you afraid of?
Okay, back to schools again, and I noticed just at the end of last year there was some pretty shocking stuff came out about one particular academy. It's a head on £230,000. He made extra cash running a health club at his school. Auditors have launched a probe into the academy teacher who also employed his ex-wife as his deputy head. Sir Greg Martin enjoyed a 56% pay rise last year, earning £230,000. A head teacher, he raked in cash running his health business, and his firm has been paid £500,000 in management fees out of public money over the last 3 years. And the National Audit Office is looking into it, but is unable to determine the extent of his benefits, believed to be one of the highest paid executive heads anywhere in the country. This chap, Sir Greg Martin, has also got a knighthood as an academy head. So it's obviously somebody somewhere thinks that he's good at what he's doing.
Well, obviously, it sounds like this guy's got a very nice life. Thank you very much. I mean, six-figure salaries are something that you see in academies across the country, and we certainly see them in Bristol. I don't know that anyone's being paid quite as much as £250,000. But certainly what you do see is the chair of governors also being on the trustee body, and you know, you've got the same people running the school as you have running the sponsor. And again, I would agree with you, Daphne, that actually it's really very difficult when you start asking questions about where's the money going, how do you proceed, you know, who is it that's doing these particular things?
So, well, we've heard Daphne's experience. What's yours, Christine?
Well, I suppose the best one that I can give here is when the Cathedral Primary School said, oh, I think we'll have your library, thank you very much, to put our primary in there, what I did was look to see who this school was going to be serving.
Oh, that's the public library, Bristol Public Library, isn't it?
Yeah, is it?
On great College Green.
Yeah, absolutely. And so I looked at to see who this school, who's going to get places at this school, because I understood how the secondary was operating and I knew that it would be the same people that were wanting to open the primary. And they're serving three local authority areas by this random allocation. So I was kind of like, okay, I'm interested in how and who randomly allocates these places. And so I was then looking at the law to see, because I was like, you know, okay, so it, you know, you're allowed to randomly allocate and use this particular method, and then it says it needs to be administered by somebody who's independent, which immediately made me kind of go, okay, well, who are the people that were doing it then? So I then asked the Freedom of Information request of the secondary school that had been using this random allocation, and I had to chase that school in order to get the names of those people out of them. And it turns out that actually one of the people that was doing it was a guy called Hugh Monroe. Now, Hugh Monroe was the head teacher when the cathedral was private, and he was one of the people that wrote the original expression of interests to turn it into an academy to get state funding. And another person that was apparently an independent person that allocated the places was a guy that was part of the steering group that set up the primary school, advising the school about admissions policies.
Now, I mentioned this Durand Academy in Southwell in South London. I mean, this chap, this headmaster I mentioned just now, he's basically using the school as his own kind of private property to use various buildings for his own businesses and that kind of thing. Have we got any examples of that here in Bristol?
Not that I have come across, but that's not to say that those examples aren't there.
Okay, well, folks, if anyone knows anything...
anybody has any ideas about where the contracts are going for maintenance, construction, you know, which company owns the firms that are kind of, you know, maintaining and running these schools, it'd be really interesting to know.
I wonder if they're also going to merchant venture firms, who knows?
Wouldn't that be interesting? Who does the accounts? Who does all the, you know, all the legal letters when John Laycock has to go to court?
There was one issue, wasn't there, with Merchants Academy down south of the city about trying to install a rifle range, I believe, in one of these schools when it was first being constructed. Do you know anything about that?
No, I don't. I first heard that from you.
Oh, really? Okay.
I didn't know they were trying to get a rifle range down there.
Yeah, pretty amazing stuff. Anyway, look, one of the side aspects of this is the sort of blurring of the lines between government and business. And one of the ways that that's happened is through these so-called partnerships. And we've got lots of those now. Merchant venturers on the local enterprise partnership. And we're going to be looking at that in a minute. After Christine, you've been through some of the individual characters and merchant venturers on running various schools in the city.
Yeah, so there, I mean, currently there are 9 schools in the city that are either run or sponsored by the merchant venturers as an organisation, or have merchant venturers heavily involved in the governance and the running of it. There's a 10th that's about to be open down on the old Fairfield, the old Montpellier site where Fairfield used to be. So there's going to be another primary school that's opening there. And, you know, Colston Girls, if we look at who the chair of governors is for Colston Girls, and their feeder primary school, the Dolphin, a guy called Trevor Smallwood. So he's a merchant venturer. Interestingly,
Jackie Cornish.
She is, her name appears there. A guy called Andrew Yates. He's also a merchant venturer. Chris Patterson is a merchant venturer. So, you know, these names are around. And a guy called Andrew Yates as well. So they're all involved in the Colston Girls Trust. Of course, the big merchant venturer for all the cathedral schools is Stephen Parsons. And Stephen Parsons, when you look at the website for these schools, you know, he actually went to the school. He's been involved in the school apparently for, you know, a few decades. And he's on the trustee. He's like one of the sponsors for these schools. He's the chair of the secondary school and he's now the chair of the primary school. And of course, the Church of England is very heavily involved with those two schools as well. So that's maybe another sideline issue that we can do another time, their involvement with the church.
Well, I will mention our little excursion into the Charter Day service at the cathedral, because that was quite interesting to see the bishop there basically saying, well, the merchants have almost written my sermon for me. They've booked, private booked the cathedral. And he was certainly implying that people who had instructed him that the Edward Coulson's involvement, business dealings and the criticism through the slave trade was speculation were the merchants who'd hired the cathedral. And I remember when I came out of the cathedral, I was quite amazed and surprised to see a whole massive queue of people. I mean, actually, it was a private booking for the cathedral and public money being used to bus school children in there who had no choice about whether to be there or not. So that's a whole other side
well,
to
you,
this.
Well, you know, Tony, who the canon treasurer is for Bristol Cathedral? John Savage of University Hospitals Bristol.
Crikey, I think we need it almost like a kind of a map of people.
Absolutely.
Who
yeah,
are there.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we can work
map
on that
merchants.
Map, but anyway.
And the Right Reverend David Hoyle, I think his name is of course, he's the Dean of Bristol Cathedral. So he is the person that ultimately is responsible for the bookings, if you like, that gets into the cathedral. But he is also appears as a member of the governing body on both the cathedral's secondary and the primary school.
But he's hardly likely to say, hang on, this merchant booking out of the cathedral isn't appropriate, is he?
Well,
I very much doubt that's
a question certainly for the diocese to be considered. So merchant academies, we've got a guy called Ross Ansell. So he's a merchant academy. He appears at the top. So I presume that he's the chair, although it didn't say. But
this is a guy called Dennis Wise. Okay, this is just to be clear, this is down in Withywood, isn't it?
Yes, this is the merchants. So it used to be a guy called Dennis Wise, who is also heavily involved in kind of youth and community stuff down in the south. One of the, you know, he's quite heavily involved in that. A guy called Patrick Despard, he's also on the governing body of the Merchants Academy. Nick Hood, Laura Marshall, Peter McCarthy, Tony Kenny, and Chris Curling is also on the governing body. And then we got the One World Trust. Now, the One World Trust was their first kind of venture in 2003 into academisation. It was the first academy in Bristol. It was part of the first wave. And it was individual merchant venturers that were getting involved. It was John Laycock then and it's John Laycock now. But I actually looked today at all the lists of people that are involved in the One World Trust, which includes the City Academy and Bannerman Road Primary. And it's only John Laycock who is kind of the lone merchant venturer voice that is involved in the One World Trust. So I think that'll be it'd be interesting to see whether, you know, how much longer John Laycock chooses to remain involved in that One World Trust.
Another bit of news about academies in the Guardian, they seem to really keep track of them quite well actually, is that academy schools have been stockpiling £2.5 billion of education funding. So they're taking the money, but they're not necessarily spending it on the kids. I'm not quite sure where they're investing that or where it's going. But anyway, let's have a look now at... Have you finished your list, Christine?
Yes.
Okay, let's have a look now at this whole business of partnerships which have come in over the last 10, 20 years or so, where business is involved with government in managing how public money is spent. And we're going back to good old James Garrett's documentary from 1995, part of West Eye View on HTV.
4 years after its formation, the Bristol Development Corporation is well on the way to transfer...
Over the past decade, local authorities have lost much of their power and money to unelected boards or quangos. The principal quangos locally, like the Bristol Development Corporation, are headed by merchant venturers. BDC chairman Christopher Thomas is one of three merchants on the board. The Avon Training and Enterprise Council, annual budget £30 million, is headed by the newest merchant, Colin Green, head of Rolls-Royce at Patchway. The board of the United Bristol Healthcare Trust, which runs 9 hospitals, including the Royal Infirmary, is headed by venturer Bob McKinley. Another merchant on the board is Louis Sherwood, also chairman of HTV and the Bristol Chamber of Commerce and Initiative, based at Lee Court. It's involved in regular consultation with the City Council over the future development of Bristol.
The City Council is very concerned about the growth of quangos and the way that democratic accountability is being lost to non-elected, appointed boards. And one hears that a lot of members of these boards are merchant venturers, and one can only speculate on the reasons why they're appointed.
We're not attempting to involve ourselves in politics. We are very careful to avoid politics. Our desire is to be involved with the city of Bristol and to be involved with the various aspects of life that we think with which we should be involved.
Well, that's pretty vague, but and also saying he's not interested in getting involved in politics. Well, I'm not so sure about that either. Now, what we've seen since then, I mean, that's 20 years ago, that, amazingly enough, that documentary was broadcast on HTV. But we've seen the whole business of these partnerships moving forwards and forward. With one of the most important in the area is the Local Enterprise Partnership. That is chaired by James Jury, who is also a merchant venturer. What these partnerships do is they have various people sitting around the table spending public money, and less of the influence of how that public money is spent is democratically elected councillors being around that table. More and more of it seems to be business people. Anyway, Daphne, let's also have a look at the West of England, I think, is what is it?
It's the Academic Health Partnership or Health Science Network.
Okay, so what do they do?
Well, this is something that NHS England set up a year or two ago, and they're all around the country. So there's one in the Southwest Peninsula. We've got one here which covers the old Bristol, North Somerset, South Gloucestershire primary care trust area, and I think it maybe goes up to Gloucestershire as well. And it's all about academia and the NHS and possibly the council getting involved to try and promote research into health matters here. And this organisation here, the West of England Academic Health Science Network, I think it's either chaired by Professor Steve West, who's the Vice Chancellor of UWE, or he's on the board. I think he chairs it. And their objective on their website is innovation at the heart of health and care to improve outcomes and contribute to wealth creation. So when I read that, I thought, wealth creation for whom? And also Steve West is involved in the Bristol Health Partnership, which seems to be another quango. So this is all part of this map of all these organisations and where the merchants are embedded in them and how much influence they hold and to what extent they open themselves to public scrutiny and accountability, especially when, as in the case of this West of England Academic Health Science Network, there is public money involved.
Well, there's a fantastic amount of public money involved, isn't there? Of course, with the two trusts spending about £1 billion of our money a year, the two NHS trusts. Back to education, though, and another Guardian article is criticising actually the Department for Education. The spending watchdog, National Audit Office, has been saying to the Department for Education, you have no idea what money is owed by whom to whom when it comes to academy schools. I suppose I better read the article out, actually, rather than just kind of paraphrase it. It says, the government's multi-billion pound academies programme, in which thousands of schools have been taken out of local authority control and directly managed from Whitehall, has thrown the Department for Education's finances into disarray. In an extremely rare move, the National Audit Office Public Spending Watchdog issued an adverse opinion on the department's financial statements, indicating it does not trust the accuracy of DfE's figures and is unable to assess whether it is providing any value for money. So this actually is far worse than it was before, Christine.
Yeah, I saw this. And this has been, I mean, there's been warnings about this for years and years and years. There is absolutely no way that civil servants sat in a desk in an office in London is going to be able to manage thousands of different academies up and down the country. You need local oversight in order to make sure that what these academies are doing are actually serving those children that need to use the state education sector. Because the local authority has the legal responsibility to make sure that every child in the area has access to state education, yet they themselves are not have no real authority and control over the people or the organisations that are running the schools. And that is this is a real issue in Bristol, because no secondary mainstream schools in Bristol are now controlled by the local authority. And what we're seeing is this massive, massive breakup. And the local, the officers in the local authority really have very little idea about what is actually going on in the on the ground. And the head teachers themselves are accountable to their governors, and they're accountable to their the sponsors. Whereas when they're under the local authority, they would have been accountable to local authority officers and therefore the elected councillors. And I would really like to see officials, locally elected councillors, really begin to understand this, because we're losing control of how our secondary, particularly our secondary state sector, actually is operating.
And one wonders whether, you know, academies are going to start going in the direction of this one from South London, with heads running them like private fiefdoms. Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers: it's not really so much that the lines are being blurred between public and private here. It's almost like actually there is no very, very little public accountability left.
Well, there's lots of public money involved. That's the point, isn't it? I mean, when the merchant venturers were dealing with private schools, as they were in the past, in a way, that's the privilege of the privileged, and there's nothing, not a lot anybody can do about it. But once you start bringing the private sector into the public sector, and partnership sounds like such a kind of reasonable idea, doesn't it? But the problem is that public money cannot be committed to private uses, especially when there's confidentiality and lack of transparency. And when I was involved, I worked for the council in the social enterprise department, and one of the real problems they have this idea of setting up social enterprises, but the fact is that if you've got public money involved, you can't have private money involved as well, and secrecy involved. The legal side of the council was saying all these ideas of social enterprises are not really legally viable, because actually public money cannot just be allocated to private uses. But of course that line has been very, very severely blurred. And of course the other problem is that you then end up spending a hell of a lot more than you intended and not getting the outcomes that you expected.
OK, let's sum up. Daphne, where can listeners follow your work and find your stuff on the internet, etc.?
If you just go on an internet search engine and put in South West Whistleblowers Health Action Group, you'll find us.
OK, lovely. And Christine?
I'm best found on a search engine by my name with Twitter, I would suggest.
OK, and we'll be hearing more about this, I think, in the future, especially since we've set ourselves on a little mission now to do a little map to find out which merchants are aware.
A big map, I think,
actually,
Tony.
Actually, maybe it might be, yeah. And we'll have to see if we can get that online for you. Anyway, that's it for this week. Time to sign off. Time for the Murdoch News at 7 o'clock, followed by Mohammed's Arabian Nights. We'll be bringing you the Diana story next week. Our sister show, Dialects, on Monday at 11 a.m, where we hear about the top Bristol Spanish blog. And we hear about teaching in prison. Thanks to our guest in the first hour. That was Councillor for Henbury and leader of the Conservative group on Bristol City Council, Mark Weston. I'm Tony Gosling. You can follow this show online at thisweek.org.uk or follow me on Twitter or at Tony Gosling. See you next week, and don't let the banksters get you down.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour. Live from the Sky News Centre.